This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
And welcome to Fruit Loops Season 3, Episode 4. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't hear or know much about. Now, contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are white dudes. No. There are many well-documented... Yes, that's right. We have almost 50 episodes. There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it on a future episode. Also, our website is FruitloopsPod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And if you're not on Facebook, you can join the discussion on Twitter or Instagram by using the hashtag Fruit Loops Pod Discussion.
That's right. And if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash app, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/FruitloopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. And we also have some merch for sale on our website at FruitloopsPod.com/merch. And if you can't help the show monetarily, no problem. No problem, man. You can always give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get your podcast from. And this is important. Be sure to share our show with your friends.
Yeah.
So, Miss Beth, who are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about Martin Kipp, a Native American man who murdered two women.
Ah, so before we dive into the juicy stuff, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Not a whole lot to report. Just been trying to catch up on Veronica Mars. I don't know if you watched that show or ever watched it.
I do not, but I have heard great things, mostly from you.
Resident nerd in the house.
Yeah.
So yeah, they released a new season, which, you know, it's been years and years and years since they've done a season of it. So I had watched it a while back, and so I'm trying to go through it again because I forgot a lot, so I can watch the new season.
And that's with one of my favorite white ladies.
Kristen Bell.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kristen Bell. Yeah, she's really funny.
Yeah, agreed. Well, wonderful. I'll add it to my list of things to do. Catch up on Veronica Mars. Is it on Netflix?
It's on Hulu.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I'm going to have to bootleg it. or use my mom's password. You know how we millennials do. You know how we do.
So how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for asking. Just got back from vacation. I actually just pulled into my driveway 2 hours ago. The car is not unloaded yet, but we had so much fun. We went to Minnesota. That was our destination, Minneapolis, to hang out with my brother and my husband's brother and his kids. The trip back was challenging. we had some setbacks in Colorado on the way there and on the way back. Like my daughter, when we were in the hotel room in Colorado, was throwing up all night.
Oh no.
From this trash ass Mexican restaurant. I can't even remember the name, but we were like, can we get some pico de gallo? And they brought it in a ketchup bottle.
Oh my God.
Have you seen pico de gallo made in such a fashion?
No.
That should have been our first clue. And we should have left right then and there. But we were like, okay. And have you ever been to a Mexican restaurant where you have to put salt on the food?
What?
So we had to put, that's how bad it was. And then, okay. Oh, and then on the way back in Colorado again, we were going to spend the night there and we're on our way to a hotel and we got a ticket. We got pulled over by the police. Oh, and I'm like terrified. You know how I feel about cops?
Oh, yeah.
They shoot black people left and right. And so I was like handing him the insurance paper. Like my hands were like shaking. Like,
shaking. Oh my God.
This insurance paper. And my kids were in the back and my son was, I guess I haven't conveyed the lesson. Like you have to also shut the hell up around police. Because he was like, Mommy, are those police going to shoot us? And I was like,
oh my God.
Shut up. I don't know.
My husband
was driving and my husband is not afraid of police. Like he always mouths off to police. I was like, please don't do that with our kids in the car. Please just shut up. And my husband wasn't speeding. They pulled us over, I think, because we were in Colorado and Arizona cars don't have front license plates. And we didn't have a front license plate.
Right.
So he's like looking around at the car for something to give us a ticket for. And my son, the seatbelt rubs his neck. So he moved it behind his back and we didn't notice. And, you know, we always talk about you got to wear your seatbelt properly. But it was a long car drive and he had it moved. And we didn't think to like check before the policeman came to the car. So we got a ticket for 2 seatbelt infractions.
Oh
which
my God.
It could have been a lot worse, right? But
still, geez, he couldn't let you go with just a warning.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, so we were like, we're not staying in Colorado any further. We're going to drive all night to the next state so we don't have to stay in Colorado. Now, I know Colorado is a lovely state. That was our first 2 experiences with it. And I'm just going to say it wasn't great for us. So anyway, we're glad to be back in Phoenix. We had a fun time in the Midwest. Thanks, Midwest. You guys are dope. So now we are going to dive into our mailbag. We do like to shout out our listeners. And when they say they reach out to us and communicate with us, we just want to say thank you. So let me reach for our mailbag here. Oh, there it is.
Thank you, Angels. Right.
Yes, thank you. So what's the first listener letter, Beth?
Well, we got an email from Shannon. And she said, please remember we need to emphasize these women who are discarded and not contribute to the infamy of these narcissistic psychopaths. And then keep up the good work. I'm a white lady who's getting an education, a new perspective, and I feel a kinship with you awesome women. So thank you, Shannon.
Yes, Shannon.
We do try to remember the victims. We try to say their names because they are important. And we do try to get some information about them. And a lot of what we do is trying to figure out why these guys did these things. We don't want to glorify them or anything like that. We're trying to figure out why did they do these things? Yeah.
Right. And context and is everything, right? Like our experiences shape who we are. And one thing that's not generally talked about is how race plays into a person's experience or upbringing. And so that's a thing that we try to get into when we're talking about the setting, what, you know, the time and place, the person's upbringing and the history. And all the other podcasts who talk about true crime never mention this person happened to be a person of color and how difficult that could have been in the context of their existence. And I think that that's important for the victims to keep in mind about and also the perps. So that's why we talk about all that stuff.
Yep. But thank you, Shannon. Thanks for the email. And anybody else have any comments to make? Go ahead and give us an email.
Yeah, you know where to find us.
Yep.
And keep them coming because we love them.
We do.
I was going to share an email from Brother Chris. And I say Brother Chris because when me and my husband went to a black church, all the, he's white, and everybody was like, Brother Chris. So that's anyway, anytime I've seen the name Chris, I'm like, Brother Chris. So anyways, Brother Chris sent us an email and he said, I really enjoy your podcast. At first I didn't, because I couldn't see how humor and witty satire could coexist with these stories. If you guys are looking for another great podcast to listen to, check out White Lies, he said. Thanks, he says, and signed it off with Chris. And to Chris, we'd like to give you all of the hip hop air horns because we appreciate your email and your kind words. Now, I wanted to say also, he's absolutely right about that podcast, White Lies. It is outstanding. It's by these journalists, these two white guys. They're from, both from the South. It's about the unsolved murder of a white clergyman. He was killed by the KKK. And at the time, it was in the 60s, during the civil rights movement, and Martin Luther King called out all of the clergy across America to help Black Americans in their fight for civil rights. And so these, it was three white clergymen who went down to the South together. And they all got attacked by the KKK. They were beaten in the middle of the street, and one of them ended up dying. And everybody knew who did it. But nobody in the town wanted to talk about it because they were so afraid of what the Klan might do to them. So now everybody who's in, almost everybody who was involved in this story in the 60s is dead. And so the journalists had to go and interview, you know, spouses of people and people with Alzheimer's who didn't quite remember the story, and children of the people involved, and did some deep investigating and found out who committed the murder and took that evidence to the district attorney. Who unfortunately can't do anything because the dude's dead, and I guess the statute of limitations has passed. So anyway, it is really, really fascinating to hear these interviews, the information they uncovered. So thank you, Chris. And I hope that the listeners also appreciate your recommendation. So now we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get back to the story when we come back.
We would like to invite any listeners who have a business to advertise to do it with us. For more information, please email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com or check out our website at fruitloopspod.com.
All right. So now we're back. And tell us again, Beth, who are we talking about?
Today, we're going to be talking about Martin Kipp, a Native American man and serial rapist and murderer who killed two women in the Los Angeles, California area.
So now we're going to get into the stats, which is my favorite part of the story. I like to do a little hip hop air horns just because it's my favorite part of the story. So... So Martin James Kipp, aka Dr. Crazy, still not sure how he got that nickname.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from, because there's nothing in anywhere that says why he was called Dr. Crazy, but it's in a couple of places. Yeah, but no explanation, none whatsoever.
Not a one. But he's a First Peoples or Indigenous or Native American person. But welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. Now, what to call Native Americans is, I think it's changed. It's evolving as we become better, smarter humans. Indigenous peoples or Native Americans are not a monolith. There are Indigenous people all over the world. We're referring in this story to those across the Americas. So North America, that includes Canada, Central and South America. The conversation about how to refer to them, though, as people varies from region to region. And I recently learned that Indigenous or First Peoples is a term that is preferred by American, or at least the ones who have conveyed their position on the outlets that I read and listen to. Those terms are preferred. So that's what I try to use out of respect. And if you're listening to this and you feel a different way or know of a different sentiment, please let us know, because I want to be as respectful as possible. But yeah. Kipp raped and murdered two women. I believe he also raped two additional women who escaped. So four rapes, two murders. His murder victims were Tiffany Frizzell and Antaya Howard in the Los Angeles area in California in 1983 and 1984 was when the crimes occurred. His MO was rape and strangulation, and he was sentenced to death in 1987. But before we dive into the gory details of the story, let's talk about the setting and the killer's early life, because it's very important to the person that Kip developed into. So take it away, Beth.
Martin Kip is a full-blooded Blackfoot from the Blackfeet Reservation. Blackfeet territory once ranged from southern Canada through Montana.
Never heard of this place.
Montana.
Where is it?
Through Montana to what is now Yellowstone National Park. They were a nomadic warrior tribe that vigorously broadened their territory by pushing other tribes out. By the early 1800s, they were doing battle with most tribes who ventured into the northern Great Plains. It's estimated that their numbers at the time exceeded 15,000.
Wow. Yeah. Hefty population. Yeah. The Blackfeet traded for horses with the Spanish in what is now New Mexico. Wait a minute, there's a New Mexico! Just kidding, I was there today. it was part of my road trip. And they traded furs with the British in Canada. Their first contact with Americans occurred in 1805 or 1806 when they met members of the Lewis and Clark Survey Expedition. Later, the Americans aligned with the Crow tribe, enemies of the Blackfeet, while the Blackfeet were aligned with the British.
At the time the Lewis and Clark Expedition moved up the Missouri, the Blackfeet had control of nearly all the Montana terrain the explorers wandered through. Except for one incident, their encounters with the explorers were peaceful. Around 1832, the Americans took over the fur trade, and the Blackfeet's contact with Canada dwindled.
So then, 1855, the U.S. government and the Blackfeet signed a treaty that gave the Blackfeet much of Montana east of the northern Rocky Mountains. But as was the case with all other tribes in Montana, these lands were quickly whittled down by the deception by the U.S. government, with a gradually shrinking territory, loss of the fur trade, and the disappearance of the bison. The Blackfeet became impoverished, and they became impoverished because it was the United States' intention to get them into debt. We're going to get these brown people that we've been trying to get out for forever, so we can take over all this land. We're going to make them get into debt and owe us, and then they're going to be powerless.
They're not going to have any choices. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Then discovery of gold in Montana in 1862 resulted in an invasion of and encroachments on the Blackfeet's treaty lands. The Blackfeet resisted, but their resistance largely ended in December 1869 when a group of soldiers attacked and massacred a peaceful encampment of Blackfeet under Chief Heavy Runner. This is known as the Massacre on the Marias River.
I also wanted to interject here and say, so the 1860s is probably about when things, not when things started to change, but when you drive around the United States, as I did these past 2 weeks, and I also live in the Pacific Northwest for high school and stuff, you'll see a lot of places and people, businesses, who are so proud of the fact that they, their family has had such a piece of land or such property since the 1860s. And now my question is, how many indigenous people did you guys have to kill in order to acquire this land?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that's something that people should be proud of. I'm just saying, throwing it out there. Anyway, Joe Kip was a part Native scout who assisted the soldiers during this attack, but he attempted to stop the attack when he realized at the last minute that the group being attacked was peaceful rather than hostile. After the massacre, Joe Kip adopted one of Henry Runner's sons, who was known both as Night Gun or as Cutbank John. This adopted son was the grandfather of John Kip, Martin Kip's father by adoption. So, do we got that straight?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, that's a lot of relationships.
Yeah, Joe Kip adopted Heavy Runner's son, and then that adopted son was the grandfather of John Kip, who is Martin Kip's father by adoption.
Okay.
So
he's got a pretty storied history of warriors, of brave people. Got it. Yeah.
By 1882, the bison had mostly disappeared from Blackfeet territory, and at least 600 Blackfeet died of starvation during the winter of 1882 and 1883, reducing the tribe's population to around 2,500.
That's insane.
I know. In 1884, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA, adopted regulations to discourage or prohibit Indian customs, ceremonies, and languages, with the intent to accelerate the Native Americans' assimilation into white society. Native mm-hmm. children were required to attend boarding schools where Indian languages could not be spoken. So that basically they were breaking apart their culture. They were just breaking it down.
Mm-hmm. And now I wonder how many people speak the Blackfoot language who are alive today, if any. I was listening to the podcast This Land, and there are they made it sound like there are only dozens of people who speak Cherokee today fluently. Yeah. And which is such a tragedy. And actually, it was pretty brutal and traumatic that the children were removed from their parents' homes, and they would get beaten. There's a museum in town that we went to when we first moved here to Arizona, and they talked about the Indian schools. And the kids would get beaten when they would speak their native language. And if they hadn't learned English, they would just not speak. They would sit in class silent. And I heard an interview on that podcast, This Land, which everybody should go check out if you want to know more about Native American history and the current plight of Native Americans today. An elder was saying that it's almost impossible for him to fully express himself because the English language is so different from his Native American language and all of them in sound and structure. And he, like to this day, knows what he wants to say in his native language in his head, but he's not able to express it because the translation is so indirect, which hearing him describe was excruciating for him. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, that would be really frustrating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in 1888, left with no other choices, the Blackfeet were forced to sign the Sweetgrass Hills Treaty, an agreement that gave the Blackfeet their present reservation, plus lands in the eastern side of the present-day Glacier National Monument. But guess what? Once again, in 1896, the U.S. government went back on their word, and they forced the tribe to cede the mountain lands that would become part of the national park for $1.5 million.
That's it?
That's it.
That's it?
Yep.
That's it?
Yep.
I mean, how, just insidious and evil. And the colonizers just can't seem to help themselves. It's like a habit that they can't.
Gotta get the drug.
They've been doing it since the beginning. I need that thing. I'm just gonna take it. Okay.
Yeah.
Give me that thing. After World War II, the BIA allowed tribes to decide whether alcohol would be sold on their lands, and the Blackfeet decided to allow sales of alcohol on the Blackfeet Reservation. Many Blackfeet who returned to the reservation after the war had acquired drinking habits while serving in the military or working in war-related industries. From this time, alcoholism became an increasingly serious problem on the reservation.
According to testimony later at Kipp's trial, Blackfeet and other Native Americans who leave their reservations often experience low self-esteem and lose the support of their communities. They may lack internal controls on their behavior. For this reason, Indigenous people who experience problems after leaving the reservation may quickly fall apart.
And I just wanted to say that I believe that this is still true today. I had a roommate in college who was born and raised on the reservation in Washington. Shout out to the Tulalip tribe. And she ended up leaving school for similar reasons. She just wasn't feeling like herself, didn't have enough support. It was hard for her family to come and visit because we were all the way in California. And it was really difficult for her to be in a white space when she had not been in a space like that her entire life.
Yeah.
And while she was also very honest about life on the reservation not being easy, but it was, I think, even harder for her to be away from it. So now we are going to get into the killer's Martin Kipp's early life. So hit it, Beth.
Martin Kipp was born on the Blackfeet Reservation in 1958. His birth mother was an alcoholic. We're not sure about his birth father, if he was an alcoholic or if he was around much, but Kip actually lived in the home of his maternal grandmother. About 12 to 14 other children lived in the two-room house, and inebriation and fighting were common. The children living there were often neglected.
Then in January 1960, when Martin was almost 2 years old, child welfare workers removed him from his grandmother's home and placed him with John and Mildred Kip, who were also members of the Blackfeet tribe. Child services in the U.S. and Canada are very quick to remove black and brown kids from their parents' homes, especially over substance abuse issues or what they perceive to be neglect when it might just be like poverty or something like that. Nowadays, people realize that it is much more traumatic to remove the child from the home. And I think these days people make more of an effort to keep the kids in the home while getting the parents whatever help they need for substance or income issues. But it wasn't the case for Martin Kip.
John Kip was very large, over 6 feet and 240 to 290 pounds. He was also handsome and muscular. That's what the article said.
Hey, okay.
John was the leader of his family and ran the family ranch on Cutbank Creek within the reservation. Because they lived on the ranch, John and Bobby were somewhat isolated from the rest of the Blackfeet community. During World War II, John served in the U.S. Marine Corps and was decorated for saving a wounded Japanese soldier by carrying him to medical aid. He was an excellent hunter, fisher, and trapper, but he was also a demanding perfectionist.
Martin followed Bobby everywhere and cried if he was separated from her. At first, John Kip seemed unwilling to accept Martin into his family, referring to him as Bobby's foster kid. But after about 6 months, his attitude changed and he began to treat Martin as a son. While growing up, Martin idolized John and tried to live up to his expectations, although he was never able to really do so. I have a few perfectionists in my life, and I'm certain I fall below there.
You can sympathize.
Yeah.
Martin and John would go hunting and fishing together, and John taught Martin to operate all the farm tractors. According to a defense expert at Kip's later trial, John did not give Martin the freedom needed for development of internal controls, and Martin had difficulty distinguishing his own wants and values from John's wants and values.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah.
John trained Martin in boxing. At this time, and boxing is one of those sports that requires a lot of discipline and stuff.
Yeah.
At this time, Martin was described as friendly and well-mannered, honest, and a hard worker. In high school, he was a gentle person who was shy with girls. He was a warm, loving, and respectful young man. Martin competed in cross country, and his coach described him as then being courteous, trustworthy, and an all-around good kid to coach.
In 1973, John sent Martin, who was then 15, and his cousin Billy, who was 11, with Billy's older brother to get some seed grain. The car went out of control, hit an embankment, and turned over. Billy was thrown from the car, and he died. Because John had sent the boys out, he felt responsible. After the accident, John began to drink whiskey excessively, and he suffered a stroke.
Mm. When John lost control of his drinking, he became estranged from his brother Max, and his marriage to Bobby broke down. He began to physically abuse both Bobby and Martin. So that didn't help. He spent more time away from the ranch and became involved with another woman. I don't know why I said it. He became aggressive and rough, and even old friends avoided him. Eventually, Bobby moved away from the ranch and divorced John, who then remarried.
Martin then moved to Spokane, Washington.
Hey, shout out to Spokane! That's where I went to high school.
There he lived with his uncle. In 1977, he received news that John had died. After John's death, there was a dispute over ownership of the ranch between the Kip family and John's widow. Martin was in the middle of this conflict and unprepared to deal with it. In the end, Bobby got nothing, while Martin received $13,000.
Wow. Martin enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. Because of the discipline and the high standards and expectations, being in the Marines was similar to Martin's previous experience as John's son. A defense witness later testified that the percentage of American Native Americans or Indigenous people who served in the military is about twice that for the population as a whole.
Among the Plains tribes with a warrior tradition, combat experience is highly valued, and members of these tribes tend to join elite combat units like the Marines and the Rangers. Those who join the military but do not have combat experience tend to feel shame and dissatisfaction.
I must point out that it's very likely that Kip experienced poor treatment and abuse from his white counterparts. I don't doubt that. Lots of black and brown men at the time, because we're talking about the 60s, fought in the United States War since the very founding of this country, just thinking, this is going to be the war. This is going to be the one. I'm going to join this one, and they're going to finally treat me like a normal citizen. But when they returned, they did not get to take advantage of the benefits that the white soldiers got, like things like the GI Bill, help with housing and education, etc. So I don't doubt that that was part of Kip's and other Indigenous men's experience at the time.
Martin was considered an outstanding recruit during boot camp, but then he was assigned to a desk job in Okinawa. Martin was disappointed and unprepared for office work on a military base in a foreign country. He developed an attitude problem, stole some items, spent some time in the brig, and began to abuse alcohol, cocaine, and methamphetamine. Martin was then transferred to California.
Okay, so now we're going to dive into the timeline and get into the actual true crime. So, hit it, Beth.
On June 13th, 1981, a woman named June M., and they didn't give the last name, it's just June M., she met Kip at a bar on the Pacific Coast Highway in Long Beach. After sitting in his truck for a while with Martin Kip, Kip drove off with her. Against her will, she couldn't open the passenger door. The door didn't work. Kip eventually stopped, and June asked to be taken back to the bar, but Kip pushed her into the back of the truck and started removing her clothes. When she screamed, Kip put a hand in her mouth, and she bit his hand, and then he began to strangle her. Kip finished removing her clothes and then raped her.
Eventually, her body went limp. She was unable to breathe and believed she was dying. Kip demanded oral sex. She said she would do it if Kip gave her some fresh air. But when Kip opened the door, she jumped out and ran away, eventually flagging down a motorist and reporting the incident to the police. June had severe bruises on her neck and wore a neck brace for 2 weeks after this incident. That's messed up. Quite a bit of damage that she had to wear a neck brace for 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Kip then went AWOL, but was later captured in Idaho and returned to California for trial. Convicted of rape, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but only served 19 months before his release in 1983. While he was in custody in the Los Angeles County Jail, he was sexually assaulted by other inmates. After his release from prison in 1983, Kip continued to deteriorate. He was abusing alcohol, cocaine, and methamphetamine.
So I'm just thinking about all the things in the traits and serial killers that we've seen in the past.
Uh-huh.
We've got the abandonment.
Yep.
A lot of them have had military service.
Yep.
Abuse. And physical abuse, mm-hmm. sexual abuse, and substance abuse.
Yep.
So on Thursday, September 15th, 1983, Tiffany Frizzell, she was a white woman, left home in Indianola, Washington, and traveled to Long Beach, California. To attend Brooks College. Because the dormitories at Brooks College did not open until Saturday, September 17th, that's 2 days later, she took a room near the college at the Ramada Inn on the PCH, Pacific Coast Highway, in Long Beach.
On the morning of September 17th, 1983, when she was supposed to start school, the housekeeping staff at the Ramada Inn discovered Tiffany Frizzell's body face up on the bed in her room. The bed was neatly made and the body was on top of the sheets and the blanket, but underneath the bedspread. She was wearing a blouse without a bra and she was naked from the waist down. Around her neck was a cloth belt pulled very tight.
There were no signs of forced entry into the room. Frizzell's purse, driver's license, and about $130 in cash were found in a dresser in the room. A damp bathing suit was hanging in the bathroom, and a map of bus routes indicated that she had used a bus to go to the beach. Fingerprints that were not Tiffany's were found on the telephone in the room, and semen was found on her body.
A deputy medical examiner performed an autopsy on Frizzell's body. The cause of death was asphyxiation due to ligature strangulation. She had a deep ligature mark on her neck, petechial hemorrhages in the eyes and scalp, which were all consistent with strangulation. She had multiple bruises on her body and a small abrasion on the back of her left hand. These injuries all occurred before death, but the absence of healing indicated that they were fresh within 48 hours of death. There was also evidence of sexual assault.
So then police went to the media asking for help. And on Monday, September 19th, 1983, a gardener working at a residence in Long Beach found a canvas bag in some bushes next to an alley. Among other things found in the bag was a book with Tiffany Frizzell's name written inside the cover and a magazine. When the gardener saw Tiffany's name, he notified police. Tiffany's fingerprints were found on the book and the magazine. Other fingerprints were also found on the book, which matched those on the phone in the hotel room. Whoa.
The residence where the bag was found was a half a mile from the Ramada Inn where Frizzell's body was found and close to a bus stop. Police believe that the murderer had followed Tiffany from the bus to her motel room and then knocked on the door. Because there was no evidence of forced entry, they believe that he used a ruse to get in. Then after the murder, he threw the bag in the bushes and used the bus again to make his getaway.
Oh, that's so sad.
It is.
And scary that, I don't know if you've ever taken public transportation, but it's something I've done all throughout my life. And I just have my headphones in. I don't even think about it. But somebody could follow you anywhere.
Yeah. And the fact that she was in her motel room and he probably knocked on the door and pretended to be, somebody from the hotel management or something, or like that.
Yeah.
And she just opened the door, thinking, you came to fix something. Okay, come on in, Scary.
Yeah. Very much so. And unfortunate for
Very sad. She was just getting ready to start her life.
Yeah, yeah. On November 10th, 1983, Kip and LaVita N., last name unknown, who were in an intimate relationship, were sharing a room at a motel in Coos Bay, Oregon. During the early morning hours, after they had been drinking together at a bar near the motel, they began to argue. When LaVita refused to have sex with Kip, he started hitting her in the head with his fists and choking her. Now, he's had boxing training.
Yeah.
So, and he's a big dude. So, yeah. I can't imagine. Thinking she was about to lose consciousness, LaVita told Kip she needed to go to the bathroom because she was about to vomit.
Once inside the bathroom, she locked the door and climbed through the window. As she was leaving, she heard Kip kicking down the door. She ran to the manager's office and the police came and took Kip into custody. LaVita did not press charges against Kip because he told her that if she did, he would kill her and her son.
That's often enough to silence most victims.
Yeah.
I think that's why a lot of people don't report crimes that are... And when you're a victim of a crime like this, I've never been a victim of a crime like this, but I'm just thinking, if they have the gall to do this to me here, how could they not find my family? How could they not, inflict pain on people that they may not even
know? And they can kill you this time, the next time.
Right. Yeah. On December 29th, 1983, Antaya Yvette Howard, a 19-year-old Black woman who everyone called Yvette, left her home in her car sometime after 10 p.m. She had recently graduated from high school, where she had been a track star and was working at a photography studio in December. And she was waiting to start classes at Golden West College. She had hopes of becoming a flight attendant.
Her mother, Maxine Breton, said that the last thing she remembers of that night was reminding her daughter at 10 p.m. that their favorite show, Knots Landing, had just started on TV. Maxine then went to bed. No one in the house saw Yvette leave that night. No one realized she was missing until the next morning.
Oh, man. On December 30th, a woman noticed a car, later identified as Howard's, parked in an alley in Huntington Beach. The woman telephoned the police on January 4th, 1984, because the car had not been moved and was emitting a foul odor.
The police found Howard's badly decomposed body covered by a blanket in the hatchback area of the car. Her blouse was open and missing two buttons. Her bra had been rolled up, exposing her breasts. Her jeans and underpants were around her ankles, and fingerprints were found on the exterior window glass of the car's two front doors and on a beer can found on the front passenger floorboard.
Wow, so the body had been there for maybe a week?
Let's see.
And was badly decomposed the 29th of December to January 4th?
Yeah, just a few days, really.
Yeah.
Five days.
And perhaps maybe. I mean, California isn't, like, the elements aren't too severe. So the sun.
Yeah, it's not that cold.
Right. So an autopsy of Howard's body indicated that the cause of her death was asphyxiation due to strangulation. Abrasions were found on her left forehead, left eyebrow, left thigh, and lower back. Bruises were found on her left eyebrow, left cheek. So you got to think somebody striking her.
Beating her, basically.
On the left side. With her, yeah, beating her, but with their dominant hand, which is most likely a right hand.
Yeah.
The back left side of her head, her left shoulder blade, her left thigh. There was internal bleeding in her eyes, which is a phrase I have never seen before in my life. And until that, it
until now. Episode.
Internal bleeding in her eyes and in her head and neck. I thought internal bleeding was normally like in your trunk area, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the where we read that was incorrect. Maybe they were talking about the petechial hemorrhage, you know, maybe that's what they meant. Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah.
The injuries were consistent with having been struck on the back of the head with a blunt object and with strangulation by pressure to the front of the neck. So now we're going to get into the next part of the story, which is in the investigation and the arrest. So take it away, Beth.
Police went to the media again asking for information. A woman came forward and said that she'd seen Yvette and a man around 3 a.m. on December 30th at a restaurant in Newport Beach. A composite sketch of the man was created and broadcast by the media.
At the time, Kip was in custody for a parole violation in Laguna Beach. By the way, that is such an affluent area. after I felt so uncomfortable being there. Anyway, after seeing the composite sketch, Laguna police officers thought that Kip looked like the sketch and contacted Huntington Beach police. Huntington Beach police discovered that Kip lived in the same neighborhood as Yvette, and authorities then interviewed Kip about her murder.
Kip denied knowing Yvette Howard and could not explain how his fingerprints got on her car. But soon police also connected him to the murder of Tiffany Frizzell through the fingerprints left on the telephone in her room and on the book with her name written on it. Police also interviewed Kip's girlfriend at the time, who told police of some items that he showed up with, including a radio that was missing from Tiffany's hotel room. Kip had pawned it for $70 and police found it at the pawn shop.
Oh, wow. $70 like in the 80s, I'm assuming would be a lot of money.
A lot more now.
Yeah. Like, I wonder.
The radio, I think, was probably like really nice radio at the time. It was a boombox, you know, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was a radio that also played tapes. And I don't know, maybe it was like a, you know, upper end deal. But yeah, $70.
Yeah,
that was a lot of money for
a
radio.
That's a big chunk of change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And her mother was the one that knew that the radio was missing and knew what kind of radio it was. And that's how it got identified, probably because it was an expensive radio. And maybe she'd given it to her as a gift for graduation or something like that, you know?
Oh, I was thinking he stole the radio from the hotel.
But it was Tiffany's radio.
Oh, okay. okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Got it now. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
The radio probably from the hotel room probably wouldn't have been that nice.
I was going to say, you can't just steal radios from hotels. That's crazy. all right. Sorry. Sorry. Now I'm back on the same page as you.
So, yeah. Okay.
All right. So, moving along. In 1985, while he was still in jail, Kip married a law clerk named Linda Ann. And on April 15th, 1987, Tom Giffen, an investigator for the Orange County Sheriff, met up with Linda Ann Kip. Giffen was working undercover, posing as a narcotics dealer. During that meeting and other meetings and telephone conversations over the next 2 days, Linda Kip asked Giffen to assist her in helping Kip escape from the Orange County jail. Giffen pretended to agree, but I wonder if he baited her, because I know law enforcement does this sometimes and is like, hey, do you want to buy a bunch of guns? And like the person is like, I guess, but I have all these guns for sale.
I wasn't really thinking about guns, but now that you mention it.
I guess I could use those, sure. And so then these people get like roped in by law enforcement into these really serious federal crimes that they otherwise probably wouldn't have ever found themselves in if law enforcement hadn't sought them out and sort of planted these ideas.
Right.
I'm just referring to there's a case in particular of a young black kid who he happened to be Muslim, and he happened to make friends with an undercover FBI agent. And the agent was like, I got these guns. You want to buy them? Or something like, I want to plan this terrorist attack. I hate these people. Don't you want to give it to America? And the guy was like, no, not really. And then he kept pushing the idea. And then the kid was like, I guess so. Yeah. I mean, if we're in this together. And he was a young kid too. So he bought it. And the kid ended up is in federal prison because of that FBI agent. So I don't know if a crime was reported by law enforcement implanting themselves and also implanting these ideas.
Yeah.
I might be really offending a lot of people by saying this, but I'm just saying, I don't know if I buy that she brought it up completely herself. I don't know.
Yeah. Hard to say. Yeah. But on April 16th, Linda discussed the escape plan with Giffen during a telephone conversation, and Linda agreed to pay Giffen $1,000 for his help, with $500 in advance and the rest after the escape. As Linda described it to Giffen, the plan called for Giffen to accompany Linda Kipp's son to the jail, and her son was like 16.
Oh boy.
From a public lobby, they would then enter a public restroom.
In that restroom, Giffen would remove the ceiling grate covering the air conditioning duct and assist Linda Kipp's son to climb into the duct. The son would then somehow make his way to Kipp through the ducts and guide him back to the public restroom. Giffen would wait in the restroom until Linda Kipp's son returned with Kipp.
Which sounds like a pretty dubious plan.
Yeah.
It's like, really? You think that's going to work?
Well, it's good to Dan Amora work.
True, but they worked on that for like a year.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, too.
Then the three of them, Kip Giffen and Linda Kipp's son, would leave the restroom and walk out of the jail. On April 17th, Linda Kipp gave Giffen $500 in cash. And the next day, Linda Kipp was arrested for her role in the planned escape.
Man. Linda Ann Kipp, 37, was granted a year's probation after promising to start a new life away from her husband, convicted murderer Martin James Kipp. She pleaded guilty to charges of conspiring to assist in an escape, and she was ordered by a judge never to see her husband again. But she was a lawyer, right? So I wonder if she was like disbarred or any of that other stuff.
She wasn't a lawyer. Right? She was a paralegal.
Oh, okay. 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 Well, now we're going to dive into the trial. So, what do you got for us, Beth?
During the trial, prosecution introduced in evidence a 16-page letter that Kipp wrote and sent to his wife, Linda, while they were both in custody in the Orange County Jail. In this letter, Kipp admitted to raping and killing Tiffany Frizzell. He also wrote that he had killed Yvette Howard with a dim mac technique. Apparently in martial arts, dim mac literally means death touch and refers to striking blows to certain pressure points on the body, resulting in unconsciousness or death.
So That wasn't necessary, but I was just thinking, okay, so I was under the impression that in some states, a husband and wife couldn't, like, testify against each other.
But they didn't.
They didn't testify, but I guess it seems like it's inappropriate to use contact or phone conversations with your spouse against each other. But when they were both in custody, so I can see how that's justifiable. But what if he was in custody and she was not? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I don't know the ins and outs of that. They were both in custody,
so I see why that is allowed in the law's eyes. So Martin Kipp was tried first for the murder of Yvette Howard, and he was convicted on August 14th, 1987 of first-degree murder, and on September 17th, 1987, he was sentenced to death. In a second trial, Kipp was convicted of Tiffany Frizzell's murder on December 15th, 1988. So both of his murder victims got justice, which I just think is really dope, including the black girl. Kipp was given a second death sentence on January 30th, 1989. So now we're going to get into, where are they now? Well, I'll tell you. In 2016, Kipp attempted to overturn his conviction using a defense often termed the preppy killer defense after Robert Chambers, the man who killed a woman in what he claimed was an autoerotic accident. Kipp said he met Frizzell on a city bus in Long Beach, California, and he claimed that she was killed during sex play when he accidentally choked her to death. And this hearing, like his case went, I don't know if it was the Supreme Court in California, but I saw his lawyers argue this in case. It's on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
Or argue this case in court. And it was the only thing I could find about this case on the internet, to be honest with you. And it was really boring and I fell asleep.
In Yvette Howard's murder, Kipp claimed that she pulled a small Derringer pistol on him during a fight in her car after they had sex, and then he choked her, but that it was an accident. Kipp's attempt to overturn his conviction was denied, and he is currently housed in San Quentin.
Shout out to San Quentin, because they are the prison where Ear Hustle, a dope-ass podcast, that we are and our Fruit Loops pod squad love about life in prison. And now that Erlon is out, life outside of prison. So cool. I don't know if they've ever gotten to Kipp as an interviewee, but maybe it's on the docket.
Yeah, we'll have to check it out.
Yeah. So now we're going to get into what we think made the killer snap and what are our takeaways from the story. So what do you got, Beth?
So according to the psychologist who testified as a defense expert, Kipp's neglect as a child caused him to view the world as an insecure and threatening place, and he developed a basic distrust and fear of people and a great sensitivity to rejection or abandonment. The same psychologist also said that Kipp basically wasn't able to form a sense of self or internal controls because of his adoptive father's stern discipline. And I do think that parents who are very authoritarian or over-controlling can cause kids to not be able to develop a strong sense of self or learn from their consequences. They're so controlled that they don't really have any consequences because they're not allowed to explore. Consequences from a parent only work up to a certain age. And then we have to learn for ourselves. If you don't have any external consequences, then you just don't learn. So that's probably part of it. And the cultural stuff that we were talking about earlier is probably part of it, but it doesn't really explain all of it. I don't really know what made him snap. I don't know. That's my answer. I don't know.
Well, I agree with everything you said. I'm trying to think if I have anything to add. I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I really do feel bad for the kid that Kipp was, because it's 100% relevant to his view of the world, his behavior, and his crimes, right? Context, his environment shaped how he became as an adult. And I'd also like to point out that people listening to this show probably already know this, but rape is a crime about power. It's not just about sex. And I think given how unstable his childhood was and his strict father or adopted father, his military career didn't pan out the way he wanted it to be or the way he'd hoped. And he probably had a desire for control and power in some way, which he lacked throughout his life. You know, in high school, it sounded like things were pretty good for him. And, you know, he may have been a little bit shy, but, you know, you add to it that liquor and doing drugs and it just made escalating to rape and then murder maybe more seamless. You know, it almost like it was inevitable.
Yeah. And I was thinking about his adoptive father, John, and how strict he was and what a perfectionist he was. And then he just fell apart. And that had to be really just confusing to Martin Kipp. Like what the hell? His whole, you know, his rock just kind of fell to pieces and then
crumbled.
He didn't know what to do with himself.
Yeah, I think that's
and the military career didn't pan out, and he probably felt lost. And
I forgot to mention that he was sexually assaulted too.
Right,
and so
he was.
I wonder what that was to a man. Right,
and I also wanted to mention that sometimes people, like a rapist goes to prison and then they get raped in prison and people are like, yeah, how do you like it? It's like, I don't feel like that. You know, it's never good. I'm not happy about that.
Anytime anybody violates your personhood or your body or your violates any part of your space is just, it's just traumatic in general.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure he wasn't the same after that.
Yeah, so, I'm sure that had something. Yeah,
criminal or not, even people. I don't know if I don't necessarily believe that people, even though they may have committed a crime, deserve to get raped. I was listening to The Breakfast Club or something, and somebody did something really horrible, and all the callers on the radio station were like, yeah, that dude deserves to get locked up and get the shit raped out of him. And I don't know if that does anybody any good.
No, and it makes me sick.
That's all I'm saying.
It makes me sick when people say stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't think that continuing to perpetuate violence or hurt helps in any way. I mean, I know there's this desire to want people
revenge,
who hurt other people to suffer. Yeah, I just have a hard time with it.
Yeah,
that's just me.
Me too.
So anyway,
I agree.
You know what? Let us know what you think.
Yeah.
We got a whole discussion going. So, you know, just get at us. Follow hashtag FruitTubesPodDiscretion or let us know what you think in the discussion group on Facebook. Come on, get at us. So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you'll excuse me, if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
So it looks like you've got a whole heap of tips. So tell us, Beth, what have you got?
Well, because Tiffany was killed while she was staying at a hotel, I just wanted to give you guys some tips for when you're traveling. So I'm just going to read them out.
Okay.
So don't draw attention to yourself. Try to blend in as much as you can. Be discreet when looking at maps. Now, we have phones, so we don't have to pull out the big map. But if you do, be discreet.
Right.
And you're looking on your phone. You can pretend you're texting while you're actually Google mapping.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your friends and family updated and check in with them regularly, even your annoying mom who you think just won't stay out of your damn business. Maybe just let her know where you are so she doesn't have to worry. I say that as a mom.
Of course.
In your hotel room, lock and deadbolt the door and keep your windows shut. And you can buy a door jammer, which I didn't know that you could, but it's a portable device that slips under the door to add another layer of protection. Then when they try to open the door, it's jammed and they can't do it.
I'm going to have to use that for my kids.
Yeah. Oh.
So they won't interrupt me.
That's a good idea.
I have an idea.
Don't let any strangers into your room, even if they say they work for the hotel. You can always call the front desk. If somebody knocks on the door and says, hey, I'm here to fix the whatever, you can call the front desk and check to see whether someone was ordered by hotel staff to come to your room. Be aware of your surroundings. Keep an eye on your personal belongings at all times and use good judgment when talking to strangers. For some people, not me, part of the fun of traveling is meeting new people. Not me. I'm like, don't talk to me. But if someone near you is acting suspiciously or if you feel uncomfortable for any reason, get the heck out of there.
Yeah. And that I think that deadbolt is key. Like, we were on the road and we were booking hotel rooms like the night of.
Right.
Because we wanted to see how far we could drive. And then once we were just pooped, and then we'd book a hotel in that city.
Yep.
And, you know, we checked the reviews on some of the hotels. Like, some hotels in these teeny tiny towns don't have deadbolts. We would not stay at a hotel with no deadbolt. You know what I mean? So, yeah, you do got to sort of make sure that the door and the locks are in order and the blinds work.
Yeah.
If you're going to stay there and feel a sense of safety.
Yeah, and so bring your door jammer.
Bring the damn door jammer. I love that. We're gonna have to find out how much one of those costs on Amazon, because I really want to get one like yesterday. So now we're gonna get into some serial killer and true crime news. And I just wanted to. By now, we've all heard about this tragic story in the Bay Area. In which three people were killed with an AK-47 by a 19-year-old white guy at a fucking family food festival in Gilroy. One of the victims was a 6-year-old Latinx boy from my hometown of San Jose, California. The festival was again in Gilroy, and police say that three victims and one suspect are dead after multiple people were shot in the Gilroy festival on a Sunday. The boy and his mom and his grandma were shot, but the boy is the one who succumbed to his injuries. The police actually arrived within 1 minute of being called, was good. Wow. But I think during the shooting, I heard on the news, the report that I'm reading for the podcast is from yesterday. But when I saw the news today, I understand that the man was able to reload his gun in between the beginning of the shooting and when the police finally shot him dead. An ABC affiliate identified the killer as a man named 19-year-old Santino William Legan. According to police, the gun he bought was purchased legally in Nevada just 3 weeks ago on July 9th. ATF and police are searching a home belonging to his father in Churchill Place in Gilroy. The home is about a mile away from Christmas Hill Park, where the festival took place. And I also learned that for this man to try to get into the festival, where people were just enjoying themselves, it was a garlic festival. So people were enjoying delicious food, music, vendors, art, family, friends, outdoors in the beautiful Bay Area. And to get into the festival, this man actually cut the chain link fence and crawled through the fence in order to enter the festival. So he obviously didn't go in through whatever entrances they had, where there might have been, you know, gun detectors and metal detectors and things like that. So anyway, very tragic story. You all probably have heard of it by now, but I just wanted to shout it out on Fruit Loops, because I feel really badly for the community of Gilroy, which is a pretty diverse city. The Bay Area in general is very diverse, even though now it's a little segregated and whatnot, but it's a beautiful community. And it's just really sad for this little boy's family.
Real sad.
So now we're going to get into the shout out section of our show, where we shout out any content by people of color, LGBTQ, women, or any true crime goodies. Well, I just wanted to say, since we were talking about a Native American perp today, that I wanted to, we did do a pretty good healthy chunk about Native American history, but there's the history is so vast.
It is. And that's only we only did a history on the Blackfeet, and it was actually very truncated. And there's like so many tribes, so many, and it's all different. So
many tribes. Yeah. And but the history of all of them is I think important to learn if you're a true patriot.
Oh, anyway, yeah.
Because let's say they were the first Americans, and what their experiences may vary a little bit from tribe to tribe, but it overall is I don't think fair.
Right.
It's only one adjective I can come up with, and I don't want to had the episode go too long, but I do want everybody to check out the podcast called This Land, and it is about the Cherokee lands in Oklahoma. And the whole podcast was started because the Supreme Court was going to hear a case about this Cherokee land that belongs to these Cherokee people that the U.S. government is like, no, we took it over and during those unfair treaties. So just give it back to us and shut up, Cherokee.
Oh my God.
And the Supreme Court was supposed to make a decision like two or three weeks ago, before they like ended their
session.
Term or their like session. Yeah. But they were like, ooh, this is pretty messy and we can't make a decision now. So it was really odd because I don't think they've done anything like that before, at least in a while. And so when they come back, they're going to get some more information and make a decision. But all these Cherokee people are like, come on. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Just give us our land.
Jesus.
Anyway, the whole it's I don't know how many episodes, but they get into the beginnings of the tribe, the history, the very, very, very old history. And then all of a sudden, these colonizers come in and the devastation that they created and everything that's happened since then. And it's really fascinating. It's also infuriating and heartbreaking. So check out This Land wherever you get your podcasts.
Infuriating and heartbreaking. Where do I sign up?
I know, it's my favorite. But I must say, American history is not pretty.
No, it's not.
And the people who say, you know, go back to where you came from, or you don't belong here, you don't like it, just leave. Well, especially for Indigenous people, we've been here. So where are we supposed to go, motherfuckers?
Yeah, yeah.
Or Black people, where it went 9, or the person who's occupying the White House says, just go back to where you came from. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that throughout my life. And
you're from here.
Where am I supposed to? I'm from here.
Yeah, I was born here.
I came from here. Yeah. I came from here. And my ancestors were brought here against their will. Like,
yeah, fuck you, motherfucker.
Sorry. It's just such an awful like attitude. Like, just know your history and you would know that that is a terrible, unwarranted thing to say. So let's all listen and be better and be like Beth. Anyway, so where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod, and links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean Patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. We also have merch on our website now at fruitloopspod.com/merch.
Yes, that's all true and correct. This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, Look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.